Hello, this is Tom Lehrer. You may remember me from the 50s and 60s. No? Well, anyway, for the next hour, I'll be inflicting upon you some of my dubious songs. So, you've been warned.
I'd like to take you now on wings of song, as it were, and try and help you forget, perhaps for a while, your drab, wretched lives. This one is a little song dedicated to the Boy Scouts of America. We seem to have a convention here tonight. The Boy Scouts of America, those noble little bastions of democracy. Their motto is, as you know, be prepared, and that is the name of the song. That's the Boy Scouts' marching song, be prepared. As through life you march along, be prepared to hold your liquor pretty well. Don't write naughty words on walls if you can't spell. Be prepared to hide that pack of cigarettes. Don't make book if you cannot cover bets. Keep those reefers hidden where you're sure that they will not be found. And be careful not to smoke them when the Scoutmaster's around, for he only will insist that they be shared. Be prepared. Be prepared. That's the Boy Scout's solemn creed. Be prepared. And be clean in word and deed. Don't solicit for your sister, that's not nice, unless you get a good percentage of her price. Be prepared. And be careful not to do your good deeds when there's no one watching you. If you're looking for adventure of a new and different kind, and you come across a Girl Scout who is similarly inclined, don't be nervous, don't be flustered, don't be scared. Be prepared.
Certainly, as far back as I can remember, I have been listening to popular songs on the radio or on records. So I was exposed at that time, and this is, we're talking the 30s and the 40s, to the best songs of the time. And I think the songs of the time were the songs that the grown-ups sang as well and played and listened to as well as the kids, which is not the case now. I think most people over 35 or 40 would not even have heard of most of the groups that are selling millions of records these days. So I was certainly aware of the works of George Gershwin and Irving Berlin and Hoagy Carmichael and Johnny Mercer and many, many others that I admire tremendously. I probably wasn't aware why I admired them. But I think the best songs were played a lot on the radio and on recordings. We used to go down to the record shop every Friday afternoon and listen. They had listening booths where you could listen to the songs and then decide whether to buy them or not. A dying idea. But probably the first song that I picked out myself was Alexander's Ragtime Band. Even though that was a 1912 song, it was still very popular. And in fact, there had been a recent movie reviving it. And I'm amazed at how good that song is. And I used to listen with great pleasure to the recordings of Danny Kaye. He put out an album of 78. So I had seen him in the Broadway show called Let's Face It. I saw it at least 8 or 9 times. Every time my parents said, "You want to go to a show?" I'd say, "Yes, let's face it." And I learned most of his materials off the record. Again, they were not published, so I had to pick them out on the piano. And the special material, which was written mostly by his wife, Sylvia Fine, really inspired me tremendously to try and do things like that later. I wasn't able to do it at the time, but I did. Danny Kaye did a song called Stanislavski about the great Russian director, and I wanted to write an academic song making fun of academia, and I thought I could use that same format. And I took the name of Lobachevsky only for prosodic reasons, just because it fit. It's a libel on the poor man who did not in any way plagiarize. But I used it for a song which I stole from Danny, or adapted, that's a better word, from Danny Kaye, called Lobachevsky.
Who made me the genius I am today? The mathematician that others all quote. Who's the professor that made me that way? The greatest that ever got chalk on his coat. Who on mine deserves the credit? Who on mine deserves the blame? And Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hey, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I am never forget the day I am given first original paper to write. It was on analytic and algebraic topology of locally Euclidean metrization of infinitely differentiable Riemannian manifold. Boże moi. This I know from nothing. But I think of great Lobachevsky and I get idea.
I have a friend in Minsk who has a friend in Pinsk, whose friend in Omsk has friend in Tomsk with friend in Akhmolinsk. His friend in Alexandrovsk has friend in Petropavlovsk, whose friend somehow is solving now the problem in Dnepropetrovsk. And when his work is done, begins the fun. From Dnepropetrovsk to Petropavlovsk, by way of Ilyisk and Novorossiysk, to Alexandrovsk, to Akhmolinsk, to Tomsk, to Omsk, to Pinsk, to Minsk, to me the news will run. Yes, to me the news will run. And then I write by morning and night and afternoon, and pretty soon my name in Dnepropetrovsk is cursed when he finds out I publish first. And who made me a big success and brought me wealth and fame? Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hey, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Hey.
Another song Danny Kaye used to do was Tchaikovsky, which I learned at an early age. It was written by Ira Gershwin and Kurt Weill for the show Lady in the Dark. And actually, Ira Gershwin had written many years before. And Danny Kaye did it, which is simply the listing of 50 Russian composers. And it's very hard to do because it has so many consonants. An Italian opera aria, for example, you could do pretty fast because it's alternating vowels and consonants. But the song, which I used to do, and I could probably still do if I put my mind to it, goes like this. There's Malachevsky, Rubinstein, Orensky, and Tchaikovsky, Sapelnikov, Dmitriev, Churepin, Prijanovsky, Godovsky, Archibuchev, Moniuszko, Akimenko, Solovyev, Prokofiev, Tiomkin, Koreschenko, there's Glinka, Winkler, Bortniansky, Rebikov, Ilyinsky, there's Metabalikirov, Zolotarev, and Korchinsky, and Sokolov, and Kopolov, Dukasik, and Klonovsky, and Chostakovich, Borodin, Glier, and Novakovsky, there's Liudov, and Karkarov, Makeyevich, Spaschenko, Dargromis, Sisterov, Sepskriab, and Vasilyenko, Stravinsky, Rimsky, Korsakov, Sorsky, and Gruchaninov, and Glazanov, and Cesar Kukalinikov, Rachmaninov, Stravinsky, and Gruchaninov, Rumshinsky, and Rachmaninov, I really ought to stop. The subject has been dwelt upon enough. The words were printed in a newspaper feature called Believe It or Not by Robert Ripley, and that said, Danny Kaye can do this in 30 seconds. And so I took that as a challenge. So I never knew there was a tune to it. I just learned to recite it. Then I found out that Kurt Weill had added a very simple tune to it. So I began to do that at parties with great success. And I thought, well, I'll do a list song of my own since people seem to find that amusing. And I went through the States of the Union and the United Nations and a few other lists, and there weren't enough rhymes. So I ended up with the Chemical Elements, which I then managed to squeeze in at least as many as there were at the time. The recording only goes as far as 1959, and since then there have been several additions.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. Isn't that interesting? I knew you would. I hope you're all taking notes, because there's going to be a short quiz next period. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum and magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum and plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
I was certainly inspired by Gilbert and Sullivan, and because of the dexterity of the words and the marvelous way the music enhanced those words. And I did do one direct parody of Gilbert and Sullivan on one of my records, and also used the tune of the Major General song for the Elements song. I tried to write my own tune, but I thought, why bother when the tune is already there? Actually, there's another tune from the Gondoliers and another tune from Rudigore, which also fit, but I decided that I might as well do the one that was the best known. Gilbert was certainly the master of the English language and probably the greatest lyricist up to that time in English, but the greatest lyricist of all time is certainly Stephen Sondheim, in my opinion. Just a simple example. If you look at the Major General song from Pirates of Penzance, lines like, I know the kings of England and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. Well, that's fine, except that the word order is not quite what it is, and you'll say about binomial theorem instead of about the binomial theorem. Whereas Sondheim takes the same thing when he does a parody of Gilbert and Sullivan in the musical called Pacific Overtures, and he has the British ambassador going to Japan and singing a song in the style of that song. But not only does he have the feminine rhyme at the end, but he has four rhymes at the end of each, instead of just two, instead of just couplets, and he has internal rhymes in addition. Let me just read you a bit here. Hello, I come with letters from, I'm emphasizing the internal rhyme, even though you wouldn't hear it if you heard it sung. Hello, I come with letters from Her Majesty Victoria, who learning how you're trading now sang Hallelujah Gloria, and sent me to convey to you her positive euphoria, as well as little gifts from Britain's various emporia. Her Majesty considers the arrangements to be tentative until we ship a proper diplomatic representative. We don't foresee that you will be the least bit argumentative, so please ignore the man of war we brought as a preventative. That to me is dazzling. And it does what Gilbert does, only with even more power. And I started writing little parodies in high school, I suppose, and just silly songs, never thinking that would lead to anything that would be called a career. And in college, I did several, too. But that's, again, they were friends at parties and parochial subject matter. I wrote a song called Fight Fiercely Harvard in 1945. That's, God knows, it's 50, over 50 years ago. Just, again, for the amusement of my friends to sit around and never thinking that copies of it would still be selling all these years later.
Fight fiercely, Harvard. Fight, fight, fight. Demonstrate to them our skill. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless we have the will. How we will celebrate our victory, we shall invite the whole team up for tea. How jolly, hurl that spheroid down the field and fight, fight, fight. Impress them with our prowess, do. Oh, fellows, do not let the crimson down. Be of stout heart and true. Come on, chaps, fight for Harvard's glorious name. Won't it be peachy if we win the game? Oh, goody, let's try not to injure them. But fight, 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 let's not be rough, though. Fight, 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 and do fight fiercely. Fight, fight, fight.
When I got to Harvard, we had plenty of free time in those days, and I did write a little parodies every now and then. The only one, I think, during the undergraduate years that is still around is Fight Fiercely Harvard. But in graduate school, I had even more free time, and I started doing, again, things for parties, but never suspecting that there would be any audience outside of the crows at academe. And so, and even my friends would say, oh, well, yes, we think that's marvelous, but of course, it has no commercial value. The public wouldn't buy it, and I agreed with that. So, at one point, though, I decided, I'm tired of singing these same old songs, and the LP had just come in. It had just become economically feasible. It was very cheap to do it. 78s would have been out of the question, because you have to, shipping would be just the prohibitive. So, I went to a studio in Boston. I looked in the Yellow Pages, and there were two listed. Today, there's two columns of them in the Yellow Pages. But there were only two, and one was rude to me, and one was nice to me. And so I went with the one that was nice to me. And for a total studio cost of $15, I got an hour of studio time, piano, editing, everything. And at the end of an hour, we had the tape. Actually, people ask me today, I want to make my own record, and you did it. How do I do it? Well, I said, no, it's hopeless now. Because what we did, I knew the songs fairly well, so I sang it, and then we played it back. If it was okay, we left it. If it wasn't, I recorded the same song over that. So there was no splicing or editing or anything like that, or mixing. There was only one microphone. And so at the end of the hour, we had the full 22-minute, finally edited tape for $15.
Since I still appreciate you, let's find love while we may. Because I know I'll hate you when you are old and gray. So say you love me here and now, I'll make the most of that. Say you love and trust. trust me, for I know you'll disgust me when you're old and getting fat. An awful debility, a lessened utility, a loss of mobility is a strong possibility. In all probability, I'll lose my virility and you your fertility and desirability. And this liability of total sterility will lead to hostility and a sense of futility. So let's act with agility while we still have facility, for we'll soon reach senility and lose the ability. Your teeth will start to go, dear. Your waist will start to spread. In 20 years or so, dear, I'll wish that you were dead. I'll never love you then at all the way I do today. So please remember when I leave in December, I told you so in May.
I asked around before I made this record to see how many people would buy it, other than my relatives, and I figured I could probably sell 300. Then I figured that if I had 400 made, then I would break even. And then with the profit, if any, I would buy more records. So there was never any great capital investment outside of the first 400. And I did take the precaution of putting my address on the back of the jacket. So mail orders started coming in from all over the place. So it spread, but it was very, very slow. I say it's like herpes rather than Ebola. It spread very slowly. And I believe what happened was spring vacation or summer vacation, the students took the records back with them and began getting mail orders. And then occasionally some newspaper columnist would pick one up. I remember somebody in San Francisco wrote a whole column giving the price and the address, and I suddenly started getting orders from San Francisco. And then record stores began hearing about it. People would come in and ask for it. And so eventually I got some distribution. But again, it was very slow, and I went into the Army for 2 years. And America is free today, so I think I did a good job. And by the time I got out, the word had spread. So it took many years. Didn't get to England until 1958. Oh, it got there by people smuggling it in their luggage. But in somewhere around 57, I think it was, Princess Margaret got an honorary degree from the University of London, I think. I can't remember now. And in the citation, it said her musical tastes were Catholic, ranging from Mozart to Tom Lehrer. And everybody had heard of Mozart, but nobody had heard of Tom Lehrer, so immediately the press started tracking me down. And I think that's one of the things that helped get a British release, because I had sent the record several times before to British companies to see if they wanted to put it out, and they said, oh no, we couldn't possibly. But eventually they did, and I would say it certainly sold better in England per capita than in the United States.
I hold your hand in mine, dear, I press it to my lips. I take a healthy bite from your dainty fingertips. My joy would be complete, dear, if you were only here. But still I keep your hand as a precious souvenir. You died, I cut it off. I really don't know why. For now, each time I kiss it, I get blood stains on my tie. I'm sorry now I killed you, for our love was something fine. Until they come to get me,
several of the songs on that record, in fact, all throughout my career, so-called career, were inspired by types of popular songs, if not specific popular songs. I Hold Your Hand in Mine was definitely inspired by a popular song of the 30s called, it's a German song actually, called I Kiss Your Hand, Madame, and I got to thinking, well, what if all he had was the hand? And that inspired the song. It was a one-joke song. And my hometown was suggested by a song called Dear Hearts and Gentle People, which was sort of an archetype of that genre of songs about how wonderful everything was back in a small town that people came from. And that also seemed... I don't think when Peyton Place came out, but there were various novels that came out on the other side of that, showing how sordid life was in a small town.
Because those dear hearts and gentle people will never ever let you down. They read the good book from Friday to Monday. That's how the weekend goes. I've got a dream house I'll build there one day, with picket fence and rambling road.
Written by Bob Hilliard and Sammy Fain, and Bing Crosby had the big hit, and Dinah Shore. Allegedly, the title came from a note in Stephen Foster's handwriting found in his pocket after death. After his death, that is. I don't know if you believe that.
I really have a yen to go back once again, back to the place where no one wears a frown, to see once more those super special, just plain folks in my hometown. No fella could ignore the little girl next door. She sure looked sweet in her first evening gown. Now there's a charge for what she used to give for free in my hometown. Remember Dan, the druggist on the corner. He was never mean or ornery, he was swell. He killed his mother-in-law and ground her up real well, and sprinkled just a bit over each banana split. The guy that taught us math, who never took a bath, acquired a certain measure of renown. And after school, he sold the most amazing pictures in my hometown. That fellow was no fool who taught our Sunday school, and neither was our kindly Parson Brown. We're recording tonight, so I'll have to leave this line out. In my hometown, I remember Sam. He was the village idiot, and though it seems a pity, it was so. He loved to burn down houses just to watch the glow, and nothing could be done because he was the mayor's son. The guy that took a knife and monogrammed his wife, then dropped her in the pond and watched her drown. Oh yes, indeed, the people there are just plain folks in my hometown.
The audience for these records, I think, was definitely a cult audience. I mean, part of the appeal of it was, we get this, we understand this, but the public wouldn't get it, as if they were not the public. And there was that cult, therefore, in every small town in the United States, every university town anyway, and even in such outposts of culture as Australia and New Zealand. I was very much surprised that they were that popular in England, until I realized that there was a long university tradition, the university reviews. I saw the Footlights Review when I was there, and I was amazed. There was nothing like that in this country, and that was sort of standard fare. So at least the educated populace in England was not unfamiliar with this type of material. And Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were, of course, doing that. Well, Peter Cook was in the Footlights Review that I saw. So there was definitely a greater tradition. The other reason that I think it did better in England was that it was played on the radio. The BBC actually, despite all their reputation for staidness, played these things. And in fact, when the record first came out, Geoffrey Bryson of the BBC played the whole album and did an interview with me, and for New Year's Eve, as I recall, and that spread the word like crazy. I was very happy that the BBC agreed to, or was willing to play these songs. I certainly didn't push them to do so. Fortunately, I had retained the English rights to the... There was a single called Poisoning Pigeons in the Park and the Masochism Tango with orchestra, which is on the new Rhino CD, by the way. And they played that a lot. And I was even on Desert Island Discs. Sort of, I was respectable in England. In this country, never. I was never played on, rarely played on the radio, maybe at midnight on some local FM station. And I was never on television. But in England, standards are lower, presumably.
Spring is here, a suffering is here. Life is Skittles and life is beer. I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring. I do, don't you? Of course you do. But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park. When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide, but they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide. The sun's shining bright, everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park.
Poisoning Pigeons in the Park was definitely inspired by a loathing of pigeons. I don't disclaim that for a moment. I grew up in New York City, so the pigeons were not a pleasant sight. And people would actually feed them. That's what really got me angry. It would encourage them. Actually, I don't really have any great fondness for most animals. But it's interesting that enough people have, no matter how they feel about killing birds, would still have a slight antipathy toward pigeons. At least, no, I've never had any objections about that song. Whereas, for example, if I'd written a song about poisoning dogs, I'm sure nobody would have thought it was funny and I would have gotten a lot of protest. But my feelings toward dogs are similar to my feelings toward pigeons. Or at least toward dog owners, let me correct that.
We've gained notoriety and caused much anxiety in the Audubon Society with our games. They call it impiety and lack of propriety and quite a variety of unpleasant names. But it's not against any religion to want to dispose of a pigeon. So if someday you're free, why don't you come with me and we'll poison the pigeons in the park. And maybe we'll do in a squirrel or two while we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We'll murder them all amid laughter and merriment, except for the few we take home to experiment. My pulse will be quickening with each drop of strychnine we feed to a pigeon. It just takes a smidgen to poison a pigeon in the park.
It's always fun to come up with an interesting rhyme. I mean, to me, that's very important. So many people write humorous songs that the joke is the song, and there's nothing really added by making it into a song. And part of the fun is to have internal rhymes. Stephen Sondheim is the master of this, too, and Gilbert was, too. Sondheim said it shores up the lyrics. It makes it more interesting. It makes you want to hear it more than once, which I think is the criterion for an interesting, humorous song. It's not so much how funny it is, but whether you want to hear it again. And there are plenty of humorous songs which, again, have a funny joke, but you wouldn't want to hear them again. But if they're internal rhymes and clever wordplay, that makes it much more interesting to me, anyway, which is, no, I'm writing really for me, so that's what counts. Almost all of the great lyricists have done something with interesting wordplay. Rhymes, for example, interesting rhymes at one time or another. Even Oscar Hammerstein, who's not noted for rhymes, has some marvelous ones. Watching a daffodil full of caprice, eating a half a dill pickle apiece from Rosemary. And there are plenty of others that I could come up with. P.G. Woodhouse was another example. I was amazed to find, in one of my songs called Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, I rhymed cyanide with try and hide. And I thought, oh, isn't that clever? Then just last year, I bought a recording of a 1924 show called Sitting Pretty by P.G. Woodhouse and Jerome Kern. And lo and behold, that rhyme was in there, unbeknownst to me. So I don't think one can come up with a new rhyme anymore. But there's a song called Masochism Tango, specifically inspired by a song called Kiss of Fire, which was very popular at that time, and sung by Tony Martin. It was a very torrid, strong love song.
I touch your lips and all at once the sparks go flying. Those devil lips that know so well the art of lying.
He did several of those. There's No Tomorrow. He did a lot of these very bravura, almost operatic versions of, in this case, Kiss of Fire was a classic Argentine tango. And I thought, really, that's a bit over the top. So I wrote the next Kiss and Tango, which I gather is still played in various venues.
I ache for the touch of your lips, dear, but much more for the touch of your whips, dear. You can raise welts like nobody else as we dance to the masochism tango. Let our love be a flame, not an ember. Say it's me that you want to dismember. Blacken my eye, set fire to my tie as we dance to the masochism tango. At your command, before you here I stand, my heart is in my hand. Ugh. It's here that I must be. My heart entreats. Just hear those savage beats and go put on your cleats and come and trample me. Your heart is hard as stone or mahogany. That's why I'm in such exquisite agony. My soul is on fire. It's aflame with desire, which is why I perspire when we tango. You caught my nose in your left castanet, love. I can feel the pain yet, love, every time I hear drums. And I envy the rose that you held in your teeth, love, with the thorns underneath, love, sticking into your gums. Your eyes cast a spell that bewitches. The last time I needed 20 stitches to sew up the gash that you made with your lash as we dance to the masochism tango. Bash in my brain and make me scream with pain, then kick me once again and say we'll never part. I know too well I'm underneath your spell. So, darling, if you smell something burning, it's my heart. Excuse me. Take your cigarette from its holder and burn your initials in my shoulder. Fracture my spine and swear that you're mine as we dance to the masochism tango.
I had enough songs for a second album by 1959. I didn't want to put out an album while I was still performing. I know now it's quite the opposite. People put out the album and then they go out and do the concert of the album and people want to hear those songs. But I thought with comedy, it really doesn't work. So I waited until I was ready to retire and then I put out the second album. But I wasn't sure about whether people would like to hear all the talking in the audience, and I find that's a little tedious after the first few times. So I put it out in two versions, one just a concert version with just the songs and the other live recording with the audience and the allegedly humorous interstices. And they sold about equally well, so the experiment was a failure. The concert recording, it was called An Evening Wasted with Tom Lehrer, was done at Harvard. I wanted some place where I could do two concerts in a row with the same acoustical setup so we could edit rather than just take a chance on one. And that was done at Harvard. The cover photograph was taken in Cleveland, however, and I always wondered about if there's somebody in the audience being shown in the picture that was with somebody that he shouldn't have been with. But nothing ever happened. So I was not an unhappy performer at all when I was doing it. I enjoyed it, but up to a point. And after the first 500 times or whatever, then it became a matter of simulating it. And I think you have to do that. I can't imagine somebody doing the same show night after night. I've never understood people like Yul Brynner doing The King and I or Rex Harrison doing My Fair Lady night after night after night and getting something out of it. But I didn't perform that much, really. I added it up recently. I'd done about 109 concerts, I believe, in my entire career over a period of many years. So it was not a full-time job. And so I could get the energy out to do that. It was only an hour and a half, and it was fairly painless. Get out there, turn it on, and turn it off. And I think I could certainly simulate delight And it was very pleasant. I think it was more fun to go to a different audience, like to go to England or to go to Australia and New Zealand and see that the people there, that was kind of encouraging.
Sharks gotta swim, and bats gotta fly. I gotta love one woman till I die. To Ed or Dick or Bob, she may be just a slob, but to me, well, she's my girl. In winter, the bedroom is one large ice cube, and she squeezes the toothpaste from the middle of the tube. Her hair's in the sink have driven me to drink, but she's my girl. She's my girl, she's my girl, and I love her. The girl that I lament for, the girl my money's spent for, the girl my back is bent for, the girl I owe the rent for, the girl I gave up Lent for, is the girl that heaven meant for me. So though for breakfast she makes coffee that tastes like shampoo, I come home for dinner and get peanut butter stew. Or if I'm in luck, it's broiled hockey puck. But oh well, what the hell, she's my girl, and I love her.
I think one of the differences is between me and a comedian, whatever. I think comics want people to go home thinking, wasn't he funny or wasn't she funny? I wanted people to go home thinking, weren't those songs funny? And so I would perform them until I got them right, till I got the timing right and make sure it was all right. And then I would make the record and that would be it. Then they would go home and play the record. And it seemed to make not much sense to me to get out there night after night and do this, even though the audience might change, any more than if I were a novelist, I would find it silly to get out and read my novel every night to people. They should just buy it and take it home and listen to it. So I was never tempted to do that. Also, I find that I don't have that need for anonymous affection that performers seem to have. They want people they never I'm going to meet applauding. And then if the audience does not applaud or does not laugh, then they get very angry. These performers do, as if somehow they're entitled to this. So I just wanted to play for a friendly audience for a while, and then I'd been everywhere and done that. And as I've often said, if you've been to Cincinnati, there's no need to go to Cleveland. And in 1960, I realized that I had no desire to do that. I then quit. In 1965, I had another record called That Was the Year That Was, based on some of the songs that had been used on the TV show That Was the Week That Was. And I went back to the Hungry Eye in San Francisco to try them out, because I didn't want to record them without trying them out on an audience. And many people said to me, oh, you're going to love it. Once you get out there in the audience and, you know, they're applauding and cheering and showering you with money, you're going to be hooked again. And I realized after 2 weeks of that, that no, I was not going to be hooked again. That was it.
Here's a song about National Brotherhood Week.
Oh, the white folks hate the black folks, and the black folks hate the white folks. To hate all but the right folks is an old established rule. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, Lena Horne and Sheriff Clark are dancing cheek to cheek. It's fun to eulogize the people you despise, as long as you don't let them in your school. Oh, the poor folks hate the rich folks, and the rich folks hate the poor folks. All of my folks hate all of your folks. It's American as apple pie. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, New Yorkers love the Puerto Ricans, cause it's very chic. Step up and shake the hand of someone you can't stand. You can tolerate him if you try. Oh, the Protestants hate the Catholics, and the Catholics hate the Protestants, and the Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, it's National Everyone Smile At One Anotherhood Week. Be nice to people who are inferior to you. It's only for a week, so have no fear.
be grateful that it doesn't last all year.
I was a graduate student for many, many years, and that was my ideal life, to be a graduate student. I wanted to be a graduate student forever. Unfortunately, they want you to be a PhD, and you can't be a PhD and a graduate student at the same time. And I kept delaying it and delaying it. And when I quit performing in 1960, I went back to graduate school and spent a few more years, about five more years there, not getting a PhD, and teaching part-time. I taught at Harvard and at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and at Wellesley College, and various other venues. And when I quit, basically, in 1960 and put out the last records out of all the stuff that I had accumulated by that time, I assumed that would be the end of my career as a performer and as a songwriter. And the American version of That Was the Week That Was came on in 1964, and they were using original songs, and I thought, oh, I can do as well as that. So I sent in some occasional songs, and they used some of them, usually removing the best line. There was, every year, there was this week called National Brotherhood Week, and I got this idea of a song, but I had no idea when National Brotherhood Week was. And I called a friend of mine at the local newspaper and asked him to look it up, and it turned out it was next week, much to my amazement. So I immediately got to work and wrote the song and sent it in, and they used it. And that was the first one that they, of my songs that they actually used. The songs that I wrote for That Was the Week That Was were about things that had happened that week. There was a song called Pollution, which is fairly general, but it was nevertheless about some controversy that was just occurring that week about dumping stuff into the Hudson River in Troy, New York, and that we're eating it in New York City. And most of the songs, I think 9 of the 14 songs on that record, were about something that had happened just that week. And I had no idea that many years later they would still be popular. But as a friend of mine once said, always predict the worst and you will be hailed as a prophet.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale. Of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They are drinking the water and breathing the air.
By the end of the run of the TV show, I had enough songs for a record if I added a few that I had accumulated in the meantime. And so I put that out in 1965, but again, with no intention of doing anything after that, and I've kept to that. I did a few concerts at that time and some fundraising for hopeless causes and losing politicians. But 1972 was absolutely my last performance of any kind, so that's a long time. In the early 70s, there was a children's television workshop program called The Electric Company, which was designed ostensibly to teach children to read. I have no idea whether it succeeded in this. I doubt it, but it was fun anyway. And they actually asked me to do something, and I thought it was wonderful because it's the only time I've been asked to do something that was not satirical or political or something like that. So I did about 10 songs, actually, for them, of which two are now on my records, I'm happy to say. And I'm delighted. It was very refreshing. I find people now, for example, my students, who have heard Silent E, for example, which is one of these songs, and had no idea that I wrote it because there was never any credit on the show, and I sang the song, but nobody would have known that. And so they're much more excited to find out that I wrote Silent E than to find out that I wrote The Vatican Rag or Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, because it's like meeting the fellow who wrote Jingle Bells or, you know, Silent Night or something like that.
Who can turn a can into a cane? Who can turn a pan into a pane? It's not too hard to see, it's Silent E. Who can turn a cub into a cube? Who can turn a tub into a tube? It's elementary for Silent E. He took a pin and turned it into a pine. He took a twin and turned him into twine. Who can turn a cap into a cape? Who can turn a tap into a tape? A little glob becomes a globe instantly if you just add Silent E. He turned a dam, alakazam, into a dame. But my friend Sam stayed just the same. Who can turn a man into a mane? Who can turn a van into a vein? A little hug becomes huge instantly. Don't add W, don't add X, and don't add Y or Z. Just add Silent E.
Cameron McIntosh, bless his heart, who is now the leading, probably leading impresario in the world, and certainly in England and the States, was then just this kid, and he wrote me and asked if he could put together a review of my songs the way they had done with Sondheim recently, and with everybody else before that, from Duke Ellington, everybody, U.B. Blake, Jacques Brel. So they were scraping the bottom of the barrel by that time, and finally got to me, and I said, fine, but I didn't think these songs were theatrical. I thought they were really set at the piano and sing them. But they managed, largely through the efforts of the director, Gillian Lynn, who's also achieved even more greater success since then, to theatricalize some of these things. And I thought that was kind of fun. I said that I'd be happy to come over and help if I would be of any help, or be a nuisance if that was what he wanted. Or I could just stay over on this side of the Atlantic and let them do their thing. And he opted for the former. And I went over there when they got started and made a few suggestions, rewrote a few lines. We didn't want to update the material, but I wanted to just make it a little more comprehensible. And I was surprised a little that the first performances of this show would be by an English cast in England, but we didn't make it English at all. There were certain words that I said, well, don't you want to say Z instead of Z? And they said, no, but people know what that is, and we'll just keep it the way it is. So Robin Ray was definitely had a different sort of career before this, but he has a fine sense of humor, and he really entered into the spirit of the thing, and again was very intelligent, so we could have really discuss word by word the material, which one can't always do with actors. But he sang the Old Dope Peddler, and an interesting change had occurred in the ensuing, whatever it is, 27 years from the time the record came out, because originally it was supposed to be a satire, or just a making fun of songs about lovable characters using a loathsome character as the protagonist. But nobody really did that sort of thing, did drugs. And by 1980, it was had quite a different cast to it. So what happened was when he would start to sing it and would get a laugh, and then the laugh would die down, and by the end of the song it was absolute silence. And it was one of those awkward situations, or could have been one of those awkward situations, because you don't know whether to applaud or not. You want to applaud because you're conditioned to applaud because it's the end of the song. But on the other hand, you really can't, like the first end of the first act of Cabaret, where the Nazis come out and sing the song. What do you do? Do you applaud? And so we solved the problem by having him sing it. First of all, I suggested totally without affect at all, just sing it absolutely straight without any kind of glee or anger or anything. And then we went right into the next song without waiting for applause.
When the shades of night are falling, comes a fellow everyone knows. It's the old dope peddler, spreading joy wherever he goes. Every evening you will find him around our neighborhood. It's the old dope peddler doing well by doing good. He gives the kids free samples because he knows full well that today's young innocent faces will be tomorrow's clientele. Here's a cure for all your troubles. Here's an end to all distress. It's the old dope peddler with his powdered happiness.
For many years at University of California at Santa Cruz, where I've been teaching part-time for many years, I taught a course in musical theater where we did reading performances, script in hand and just a piano, no mics. That's one of the things that I think has ruined the musical theater for me. I don't like to see amplified shows. I was concentrating on what is often called the golden age of the musical, which is From Oklahoma to Fiddler on the Roof, or some people enlarge it to Pal Joey to Cabaret, which would be 42 to 67. Since then, I think it's all gotten very large. And that's what we would do. Students would get up and do these things, and I would play the piano and try and remind people of this genre, which is pretty much dead now, except for an occasional revival. But even the revivals are over-miked and overstaged and overpriced. So I don't think anybody really knows what those musicals were like. People ask me, you know, you should be writing, or why aren't you writing, or something like that. And I really never regarded writing songs as a career or something that I did full-time. 37 songs in 20 years is hardly what I would call a career. But what would happen was I never sat down the way a songwriter would do to say, well, today I'm going to write a song. Today I will write a funny song. If I got an idea for a song, I would write it. And if I didn't get an idea, I wouldn't write it, but it wouldn't bother me. I wouldn't consider it writer's block or anything like that. So as the years went by, the latter condition of not coming up with funny ideas prevailed over the former. And so I just haven't written anything. But it isn't. If I thought of a funny idea, I would not restrain myself from writing it. Even if I wrote some more songs, I wouldn't perform them. I mean, I really have no interest in that. I would perform them once or twice to get them right before an audience, perhaps, but I have no desire to resume a performing career, certainly. That was not my idea of a good time. For one thing, I'm not a night person, that's really an evening profession. Just when the evening was, you were looking forward to a nice dinner and a pleasant evening, that was when you had to go to work. I didn't like that at all. Fortunately, I had something to fall back on. I had something that I'd been doing all my life. Yeah, I'm teaching, particularly. Not necessarily doing mathematics, but teaching it. And I can still do that. And I still am doing that. Whereas most performers, I don't think, have something like that. And so if they quit, what would they do? Retire to their farm? George Burns says, what would I do all day? Play with my cuticles. You know? There would be nothing to do. And also, they need that. I think so many of them do that. I've seen them in action. When I was working in nightclubs, and we had to cut the show because it was running late, and everybody else would say, oh, you can't, I can't cut, you know. I need 20 minutes, I need a half an hour, whatever. And I would say, sure, cut it, take me out entirely. It's okay with me. But I did not have the temperament of a performer, which really, you have to be out there doing something. And I'm quite happy to get the royalty checks as a form of adulation instead of actually having people hitting their hands together.
When you attend the funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. Oh, we will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. Down by the old maelstrom, there'll be a storm before the calm. And we will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. Oh, we will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a tedium when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. Oh, we will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. You will all go directly to your respective Valhallas. Go directly, do not pass, go, do not collect $200. And we will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo, when the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
An Evening Wasted with Tom Lehrer was produced, for reasons which elude me, by Kevin Howlett, and was an independent production for BBC Radio 2 by Howlett Media Productions, who evidently have nothing better to do with their time.